You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
Well, I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, February 13th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Melissa Gira Grant, contributing editor at Jacobin, on her book, Playing the Whore, The Work of Sex Work. Also on the program today, Kick the Can. The AstroTurf organization to fight the nation's debt. Well, new documents reported on by Politico show, guess what? They're in debt.
Fiscal responsibility, yes, starts at home.
If I seem short of breath today, it's because last night rib was cracked laughing so hard at that story.
Can we please get the guy back on the show?
Well, I suppose. Also on the program today, Fast Track for TPP. Nancy Pelosi says, no way. Also on the program today, Time Warner. Well, Comcast seeking to buy Time Warner. It's like, you got that bad service in my complete monopoly. Also, a blistering commentary from Myla Cedar on Mayor de Blasio's decision not to cancel school today, and my rebuttal that will come later in the program. This story, we've been following this. As you know, we've been talking about this for the past couple of days. Right now, in Tennessee, Chattanooga, Tennessee, to be exact. There is we are on day two of a three-day period where Chattanooga Volkswagen workers, UAW or potentially UAW workers, are voting whether or not they want a union. We know that when they signed cards, there was a majority that wanted to have a vote. And Volkswagen has, to the extent that they have come out publicly, have seemingly supported the unionization drive because it's the only way they can get workers' councils, which they have found in the vast, overwhelming majority of their plants, has been instrumental in their efficacy in building cars that people want to buy. There has been an unprecedented amount of interference by outside agitators to fight against this unionization that the workers seemingly want and that the plant seemingly wants. And that has been perpetrated by Republican lawmakers. The latest is that yesterday, Senator Bob Corker came out and said, I've had conversations, and based on those, I am assured that the workers vote against the UAW. Volkswagen will announce in the coming weeks that it will manufacture a new midsize SUV here in Chattanooga. Volkswagen was so offended by this that they had to come out with a policy to a response shortly after. In a brief but bluntly worded statement Thursday, they said a vote this week on union representation at Chattanooga, Tennessee plant would have no bearing on whether it will build a new crossover vehicle there. So we now have Republican lawmakers saying it's completely un-American to unionize this Chattanooga plant because they think it might preclude them from subsidizing this foreign company from building a new vehicle there. And we have this company saying he's lying. Bob Corker is lying. Now, I guess you could parse Bob Corker's statement in which it would the VW people said, we're probably going to put it there no matter what happens with the vote, which is exactly the statement that Volkswagen came out there. And he's trying to imply that that vehicle will not be made there if the union votes the workers vote to unionize. The only sort of like fly in the ointment is that there's been obviously a massive snow falling there, and there have been two shifts now that have been canceled, which means that it's that much tougher to get the majority of workers to vote in favor for it because they haven't shown up at work. So we shall see how this turns out. But this is a very important moment, a big deal to have a plant unionized in Tennessee. Used to be about 30 years ago, 40 years ago, 25%, I believe, of workers in Tennessee were unionized, private unions. Now it's about, I think, 4%. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Melissa Gira Grant on her new book, Playing the Whore, The Work of Sex Work. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Melissa Gira Grant, contributing editor of The Jacobin, has had pieces in The Guardian, Slate, Jezebel, amongst other places, and author of the just released, I believe, Playing the Whore, The Work of Sex Work. Welcome to the program, Melissa.
Hey, Sam. Thanks for having me on this incredibly grim day in New York.
Yeah, it is. The weather is horrible here, but all right. Well, so let's get into this now. Let me just start off by saying I haven't had a chance to read the book. I've read a number of your pieces, and I saw a review of the book by Mike Konzel in Wonk Blog, and it is there's a couple of things. Let's just start with the your book calls for an overhaul on how we understand sex work. Let's start with the history of sex work in this country, just to get a sense of where, you know, where this issue starts in America.
Sure, and you're not alone in not having read the book, because it actually isn't out yet for another month. So this is exciting, actually, that the people are jumping in and tangling with it. And I thought my console had a really great perspective on it on Wonk Blog. Yeah, history of sex work in the United States. There's so much. I'll just kind of give you the gloss. And there's definitely more historic detail in the book and also some other pieces that I've done for Alternet, talking about the moment when prostitution actually wasn't illegal in the United States. So we actually have only had kind of this full criminalization of prostitution in the United States and some other forms of sex work and related commercial sexual activity for maybe like 100 years. You know, even in the 19-teens, right up to the beginning of World War I, there were quasi-legal red light districts operating in major American cities. The last one closed in New Orleans in 1917. So this is, we've had a very complicated mess of laws and policies and attitudes about prostitution and sex work more broadly. And it's only been the last 100 years that we've sort of said, you know what, the people who should be controlling the sex industry are going to be the police. And, you know, there's a lot of players involved in kind of moving to that perspective, you know, rather than looking at prostitution as a form of economic activity, even something informal and underground. You know, we didn't even always have a name for somebody who sold sex up until, like, the end of the last 2 centuries ago. You know, the idea that there is this person called a prostitute and that what she does is sell sex, you know, this is a pretty informal economic activity that really only has crystallized in the last 100 years or so to look like it does now. And it's changed so much in the last 10 or 15 years. You know, it's almost hard to go back to those old-timey laws. Like, it feels very quaint, you know, to look at a lot of them now and try to hold up something that was meant to regulate a brothel to, you know, what happens now on the Internet. It's a very different environment now than it was the last time. You know, a lot of these laws were really looked at and implemented.
All right. Well, so wait a second. All right, so let's start with what were the sort of the primary factors that were driving, I guess, sex work? And it wasn't called that, obviously, 100 years ago. But what were the primary factors in, I guess, criminalizing this activity?
I think a lot of it actually had to do with race and immigration, to be totally honest. When I looked back to Louisiana, because I was so curious, like, how did we have a situation where we had, like, a legal red light district operating even into the 20th century? And I looked back at their laws on prostitution, and the first anti-prostitution laws in Louisiana involved some crimes, things that were defined as crimes, like being a black woman speaking back to a white person on the street, being a vagrant, loitering. These were like crimes of status and crimes of poverty. They didn't have a lot to do with actually selling sex. It was about being disruptive and disorderly. And you see that even to today, where some people, you know, are getting charged with really vague things like disorderly conduct if they're profiled as selling sex in a public space. So a lot of the laws actually didn't seem to have a lot to do with sexual behavior at all, because there's always been a lot of commercial sexual activity that's happened behind closed doors that people never even see. And, you know, it really was only at the turn of the century, the turn of the 20th century, where that kind of activity was also targeted.
Interesting. And then you speak of the changes in over the past 10 to 15 years. When you talk about those changes, is that a function of essentially, I mean, technology, or, I mean, has there been a change in the law? Was there over the past, because part of your book also deals with the relationship with sex work within the context of feminism. Has there been a, through those past 100 years, from the time that it was basically criminalized, where were the sort of significant milestones in a change in perspective on sex work?
Sure. I mean, it's fascinating, like, all the different players in changing our laws about prostitution and how they recur. So if you go back to, you know, the Progressive Era, if you go back to kind of the age of the Women's Christian Temperance Union and women's suffrage, you will find in some of those things that we would recognize now as, like, first wave feminism, some of the activism that they were engaged in was closing down red light districts. And it was an extension of their attitudes about alcohol and prohibition. And those were the people, in part, responsible for this move to pass red light abatement laws, which we saw in Iowa and California, and then kind of piggybacking from state to state. So most of these laws are state-level laws, and then there are some kind of city and municipal laws that might vary as well. And so then, you know, pulling the clock forward, moving up to like the 70s and the 80s, when we see a resurgence of this anti-prostitution feminism, you know, it's couched in slightly different language. Like now that it's not about temperance, now it's about violence against women. It's not about red light abatement, it's about going after the demand. And the demand here is, you know, in some ways the same way they were talking about temperance, this is about men's bad behavior. We want to, you know, protect women from male violence. And they describe this particular, you know, sentiment within feminism, it's certainly not all feminism, but the anti-prostitution feminism looks at all commercial sex as a form of violence against women. There's no space in that analysis to look at this as economic activity. And when it's all seen that way, then those the laws that they propose out of that, the anti-prostitution laws that we're seeing in the this period and over the last decade, are a lot more focused on this idea that anybody who does sex work is a victim, just of circumstance, just by doing sex work. And, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean that those people aren't arrested, just like they have been for the last 100 years. It doesn't mean those people don't suffer the consequences of a criminal record. But now their status is being redefined as a victim, and this is somehow seen as, you know, a more feminist approach, which I would dispute.
All right. Yeah. Let's get into that, because how have the laws, so the, at least from a sort of a, I guess, a cultural perspective, there has been this sort of shift where there's a perception of sex workers as always a victim. I mean, clearly, you know, and this is where you talk about the conflation of issues of sex trafficking. Of trafficking of sex workers, I guess, with the existence of sex workers. Just we pull that apart for us and tell us why that conflation is so problematic.
Sure. I mean, part of it is, it comes from wanting to look at sex work as sort of this very distinct, unique, and, you know, special, or perhaps like more degraded industry than any other kind of work, right? So like let's flip it for a second and talk about another industry where force and coercion and trafficking is found, right? We could talk about garment work, we could talk about agricultural work. You know, when we talk about forced labor in those industries, I've never come across anyone who feels the need then to say, well, if you were forced to sew a shirt, then every circumstance under which anybody has ever sewed a shirt,
right,
is also coercive and you were forced into it. So there's an exceptionalism around sex work that I think has much more to do with our stigma and shame around sex than it has to do with anything really intrinsic or essential about sex work. You know, this book comes out of not just my own experience as a sex worker, which is just one experience, but also being in community with sex workers in very different in very diverse circumstances. And my understanding, both from, you know, the people who shared their stories with me, from the reporting that I've done, from the organizing that I've done, is that that range of experiences is not reflected in this very narrow way of, you know, trying to put sex trafficking over here as like one separate category and sex work over here as a separate category. Like, all of us at work experience things that we would not otherwise do. That's why it's work. That's why we are getting paid to do it. You know, like, I think, like, exceptionalizing sex work and saying, well, we have to hold these people to this higher standard of consent than we even hold other workers, you know, like, the anti-prostitution feminists will sometimes throw out this bogus statistic that I have no idea how it could even be determined, that 89% of people in prostitution would rather not do it. And I would love to see the companion statistic for other professions. Like, I would love to say, like, well, what about police officers? What about people who work in a dangerous mine? What about the auto workers you were talking about earlier? You know, like, what about teachers? Like, you know, it's, I think that it doesn't really serve us to exceptionalize sex work and treat it as something that's somehow totally separate from all of the other kinds of work that are going on in the world. And I think the reason that we do that is, you know, sex workers have long, even before criminalization, had an outcast status. And so it's really easy to say, well, this group of people are separate from everyone else and different and to an extent disposable. I mean, that's what we're doing when we're criminalizing this activity. We are putting people at more risk. We are making people more vulnerable to exploitation. I think the thing that's most striking for me is I've talked to folks who are organizing as sex workers, as workers, you know, looking at folks in Cambodia, looking at folks in India who, you know, are incredibly vulnerable in some ways to coercion because of poverty, don't necessarily have a lot of political capital, but are standing up and taking their rights as workers. Like, that's something that's incredibly hard to do when what you do is criminalized. And so when I look at the United States, I say, well, of course people aren't used to hearing sex workers standing up and claiming their rights, because who in a criminalized environment is going to do that? Like, in a way, we've criminalized activism and advocacy. We've made it that much harder for people to stand up and claim their rights. The people who are most positioned to fight exploitation are the people in the industry, but we've created this environment where they can't even stick their neck up for fear of the consequences.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I have to say that, you know, as I was prepping for this interview, I was surprised at, I just was not aware that there was, you know, I mean, I sort of vaguely aware of like Nicholas Kristof's sort of, you know, sort of a painting with a very broad brush, but I didn't realize this was happening within the context of feminist, you know, sort of in that quasi-academic feminist and activist world, I guess, fully activist, mm-hmm. but quasi-academic world where this was happening, because my sense has always been like, you need to empower people. And this, what is the, I mean, from your perspective, and what is the impetus behind this conflation? Is it simply just that people are not comfortable with the notion that people would commodify their sexuality? I was a former sitcom actor, and I felt like that I couldn't have debased myself more in some respects. In terms of
my worst job is when I had to be an Easter Bunny at the mall.
I was the Easter Bunny at the mall too, actually.
Really? That's like a terrible job. Children grope you. You can't speak. Anyway.
Well, and there's also children. Yes. I had children who were just simply terrified of me, and watching the parents mm-hmm. insist that they take a picture with this like 8-foot bunny.
God.
But
it's a sick world, man.
It was, yes. But all right. Well, so where is that coming from? I mean, why?
I think part of it is sex. I think part of it is that, you know, it's certainly not true across the board. I mean, the one thing that I don't want to do is to say, like, this, there is this, like, feminist opinion that sex work is always exploitative, because it's not true. I'm a feminist. I've, you know, feminism is a huge part of my political activism. And the reality is, you know, there have been moments within the feminist movement where sex workers have been consciously excluded. You know, one of them was in the late 70s. I feel like we're watching another one again, where this, the 70s one had more to do with porn, and now this one, I think, you know, this moment has more to do with this idea of sex trafficking and how it's a pressing issue. And when I look at both of those moments, what I see is not just a breakdown around sex and like as you were saying, like people being concerned that, you know, sex is being commodified and that, you know, in some ways even that sex is being used in a violent way. You know, there's certainly rhetoric coming out of the 70s, and I hear it, you know, echo today. Gloria Steinem a month ago was saying that, you know, prostitution is all rape. It's forced bodily penetration. And I cannot really square a feminism that really wants to, you know, value people's agency and the ability to define their own experiences to then turn around to an entire group of people who have engaged in sex work and say, actually, that experience that you had that you thought was consensual, no, it wasn't. It's like very hard for me to hold on to that. But I don't think that that's the dominant belief. Right. I think a lot of it is just that the particular people who are pushing this conflation of sex work with trafficking sometimes are in positions of institutional power. Sometimes they have the ear of lawmakers. And frankly, it's very hard, I think, for politicians and even, you know, grassroots activists, even social justice-minded activists to stand up and say, well, hold on a second. You know, what are we doing when we are saying that all sex work is forced, all sex work is trafficking, therefore we need tougher laws to crack down on it, when we are already in a position where the police are in an antagonistic relationship with sex workers, and we're exposing those people now to even more violence, including people who are facing coercion, including people who are facing violence in the sex trade. It's an incredibly hard line to walk, and I hope this book is a tool for people to start to pull apart those conversations. You know, folks who primarily identify themselves as progressive, people who, you know, are doing activist work around police abuse and brutality. Like, I think that those are the folks who are really well positioned to start to question us and say, what are we doing? You know, when we're relying on a law enforcement to do the work that actually is the work of community organizers and activists, you know, to do the work of empowering sex workers. What are we doing when we're asking law enforcement to take up this job and basically regulate the sex industry without a lot of transparency and oversight?
Yeah, I mean, it just doesn't seem to be like an if your goal is to get rid of trafficking, it seems like the least efficient way is to say there is no distinction between those who are, forced to work in these circumstances versus those who choose to engage in sex work as opposed to, you know, some other job that that may or may not have more or less satisfaction. So, all right, let's turn to just that notion of police regulating it, because I think in Konzel's piece he breaks it down to the from in terms of policy proposals. Now, the policy proposals that you talk about, I mean, what's the agenda here? It's to empower people who are working by choice, and I guess also to make sure that there's no exploitation going on.
And even more simpler than that, you know, are we listening to sex workers? I mean, I am floored by, you know, the times that I'm able to watch, you know, testimony that sex workers are giving in front of policymakers when they aren't even asked to, which is very rarely, on the laws that are going to most affect them, and how often they're dismissed, exceptionalized, you know, told that they're not representative of all sex workers. Like, we're not even at the table when it comes to policy. And so I'm rather than even proposing any particular policy, what I'm proposing is we cannot move forward on any policy that doesn't actually include the people most affected. And in this case, that's sex workers themselves. Sex workers also have the wealth of information and expertise on the sex industry. So it's sort of a non-starter to say we're just going to come up with this policy that, you know, is about this group of people that we don't feel that we even have to regard them. And that's because of stigma, right? I mean, that's because people think that nobody would ever do this by choice, and these are people who all that they want is for us to rescue them from this, and not actually understanding that even people who've experienced force and fraud and coercion in sex work, people who would fit, you know, this legal definition of somebody who's trafficked, those people are not served for being left out of the room either. You know, I think that in some ways it doesn't necessarily require us to come to some big opinion about, you know, our feelings about sex work as individuals, as a culture, as, you know, as a country with a set of laws about it. We have to really be pragmatic. And if we are, you know, shutting people out of the conversation who have the wealth of knowledge and experience because this is their daily life, I think that, you know, we've already lost. And that's probably part of the reason that our laws don't work. It's part of the reason we are seeing the exploitation that we're seeing, is the people who are best positioned to make change in that are completely left out of the conversation.
And they're left out of the conversation basically because there's no space for them to, if they are, if they're engaged in this consensually, there's no space for them to come out and say, you know, I'm living a middle class life doing this. I mean, is that basically how the doors are shut?
Right. I mean, what incentive do you have if you're still doing sex work to come out about being a sex worker? You're not only jeopardizing your livelihood, but you're also possibly exposing yourself to law enforcement. There's no incentive to do that, and yet people do. Like, that's the other thing that has been remarkable in the activism that I've seen in the United States, where, you know, sex work, prostitution, and some other related activities are criminalized, is, you know, I would think, oh, well, then that would mean the sex worker rights movement are people who, you know, are mostly doing legal work, but it's not the case. There are people who are doing criminalized work who are out and doing advocacy. But even when they do that, they are very often not listened to. They're, you know, dismissed You know, but I've experienced this myself, like, you know, going to panels, going and speaking, you know, about sex work issues. Like, one of the most common things I hear from people who have opposition to sex workers' rights is, but you can't be representative. Like, just the fact that I'm there and speaking and talking about this from a political perspective, they don't expect to hear that. Like, we have to, like, really shift our own expectations of, you know, what we think a sex worker looks like and who a sex worker is. Like, this is pretty 101 stuff, I feel like, that I encounter. And, you know, this book is just part of trying to pull that apart to be supportive to the people who are doing that advocacy.
So, in other words, just the fact of your speaking out disqualifies you because of the presumption that if you're speaking out, then you're not indicative of people who engage in sex work.
Exactly. Because I don't look like what they think I should look like, or obviously because I'm speaking out, I must be privileged. And in many ways, I am. But, you know, there's no reason to assume that people who are speaking out about sex work and not identifying as sex workers aren't sex workers. That's how my perspective has changed over the last 10 years of doing this work, is there are a lot of people speaking out who can't come out, won't come out for very, very, very good reasons. And that puts a lot of pressure on the few people who are out, who also don't want to be representative. Like, I don't want to speak for anybody else's experience. And that's why I don't in the book. I mean, that's why the book is about, here's what people are doing. Here are the problems that sex workers are reporting collectively. Here's the commonalities in different legal environments. Here's the different kinds of policies that have worked and have not worked. You know, this isn't just about me and my life, but I am somebody who's in a position to raise the issue, and I'm really honored to get a chance to do it.
So is it necessary for decriminalization to happen before we can have any sort of decent policy conversations about this? Or I mean, what has to happen to get to that point?
I mean, I think part of it is going to be just mobilization. I think that I'm watching organizations that historically haven't done work around sex work, like Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, come out in favor of decriminalizing sex work, which is phenomenal. So I think that's going to shift things up a little bit. You know, sex workers have been pretty isolated in the organizing and the advocacy that they've been doing, even though it's, you know, working alongside other kinds of causes and movements, you know, really closely. You know, sex worker organizing really emerged closely with gay rights organizing and around HIV and now I think issues of criminal justice reform. But I think that that's going to help. I think it'll help this isolation. People won't feel so stuck to have more allies, to have people who aren't facing those risks also bringing these issues to the table and demanding that they are taken seriously in their communities. I think that that's going to make a huge difference. The laws themselves, you know, I think it's going to be a chipping away thing. I don't think that there's a way to, like, wave a wand and have decriminalization tomorrow. There's so many different laws that interact in very confusing ways. And then there's also just the reality of what policing looks like on the ground. You know, there was a moment in San Francisco where we were very vocal as a community against the ways that police were profiling people for doing sex work based on gender and race, and we noticed that after people were very vocal about that and started doing records requests, you know, they wanted to get the numbers on, you know, who was getting arrested for solicitation and breaking that down by race and gender. We noticed a drop in those arrests, but an increase in people getting charged with things like disorderly conduct or stepping off of the curb. So, you know, if anti-prostitution policing, as it has functioned for the last, you know, 100 years, if not longer in this country, has been a way to police status, race, and gender, police are going to continue to do that even if they don't have these laws. So this is a much bigger issue in some ways even than just how sex workers are treated, but this is how this stigma and this desire to control sex work is used to police lots of different communities and lots of different people.
Has technology changed this dynamic? I mean, it's no longer, you know, you don't even necessarily need to go into, like, you know, pick up the back of the Village Voice or, I mean, it's all online. It seems like there's a much more sort of privatized, I guess, the market is far, I guess, is less opaque, you know, is less transparent or on some level, right? I mean, has that changed perspectives?
I mean, it's networked, which is really different, right? So, I mean, now we live in a moment where, you know, not only can people who don't know anybody in their offline life who are involved in sex work can go online, can reach out to people, can get advice, can get, you know, tips on how to work safely, can learn quite a lot, you know, that also breaks isolation, right? I think it's actually quite a positive thing. And it's funny that, you know, I think what's often the internet, the kind of explosion around sex work is like characterized as like a problem, like this is creating danger and this is expanding the sex industry. And, you know, it's not like we have a baseline number that we can look back to before the internet to
right.
really judge that against. We don't, there's no way to know. I do think it's changing in character. And I think that, you know, in a lot of ways it's given sex workers a lot more control over their labor. And I think it's changing people's expectations, actually, both on the worker side and on the customer side of what the sex industry could look like. I think that it's slowly starting to resemble other kinds of service work. And, you know, that's how I regarded sex work, both myself and for others that were my colleagues. You know, it really is a service job in a lot of ways. You are doing intimate work that, you know, can run parallel to other kinds of intimate work, whether that's, you know, providing a massage service, providing a therapeutic service. And the internet sort of, I think, is leading to a form of professionalization. And also to something that many sex workers haven't been able to have before, which is anonymity and casualness. You know, like, you can just put up an ad, treat the work that you're doing as like a gig. You know, how many people are patching together their incomes these days just through one gig after another after another? So in a way, it's also like it's professionalizing, but it's also making it like a little more informal and a little less of a stigma. You know, like not necessarily everybody you know knows that you're doing that work if you can just put an ad online, get some clients and take it down when you've made the money that you need to make, and maybe you'll never do it again. It's I think it's doing both at the same time, and that's, I think it's scary for people because we want to believe that there is this kind of person that, like, is a prostitute, and I think that the internet is actually really challenging that.
Melissa Gira Grant, the book is Playing the Whore, The Work of Sex Work. I guess it comes out in a month, but we will link to its pre-orders at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you. That was great. Take care.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. Should we play the blistering commentary from Milo? I guess we're going to save that for the better half. And I will rebut it. I want you to know. I'm on Team de Blasio about this, I think, for the most part.
Milo seems to be on Team Roker.
Milo's on Team Roker. Folks, in the funner half of the program, we will also talk about Gingrich Inc., essentially. It's nothing that you don't know, but it is, you know, based on that Scott Brown story from him peddling, what was it? Exercise gives you Parkinson's or something like that?
Dude, there's this new berry from Nepal that will literally regrow your immune system. I wanted to, like, let my bros know through email about this.
Everybody, check it out. All you got to do.
This is like ginkgo on steroids, literally.
It's like steroids on steroids. But Gingrich has his own, I guess his own thing that he's pushing. Also, Governor LePage up in the great state of Maine. This guy is really a sociopath. Essentially calling for more overdoses. I know he thinks he's not. He thinks he's just punishing people with death if they have overdosed from illegal drugs, but also, frankly, not prescription drugs. If we have to lose a couple of people who, you know, elderly people who are taking some type of I guess I don't know what opiate style, like Oxy or Vicodin or something, Percocet or something like that. Or if a child accidentally gets into this stuff, a couple of them have to die to punish those morally reprehensible people who have chosen to have a drug addiction. Also on the program, Nancy Pelosi says no to fast track. And that wonderful, heartwarming story of a fake grassroots organization arguing that policymakers must keep this country out of debt, even if we have to cut old people's pensions to do so. It turns out they can't balance their checkbook. So all that and more. Folks, a reminder, tomorrow on the program, Cliff Schechter will be joining us. Also, to give us an Oscar preview, ladies and gentlemen, Chris Rosen. If you are new to this program, and I know thousands of you are, and were not a listener 2 years ago, I guess it was, Chris Rosen was the only guy we used to give movie reviews, and he was a movie reviewer. He worked at that time at, what was it, Movie Line? What was it?
It was Movie Line, yeah.
Movie Line. And about a year into it, he used to be a guy who worked at Air America. He was writing for Movie Line, so I would have him come in and review movies. About a year and a half into it, because his movie reviews were, I thought, lacking.
Is the anti-film guy, Matthew.
Anti-film guy, Matthew. A year into it, it came out, he conceded that he had never done a movie review for a Movie Line, that he was just basically...
He was a vertical editor.
A vertical editor. I don't know what that meant. He is now at HuffPost. He does entertainment reporting, I guess. I don't know. But he's going to give us an Oscar preview.
Chris Rosen was always a fun guest, and we took advantage of it.
We took advantage of it, and he got upset.
Yes.
And so then he wouldn't respond to me for months.
We had Kyle pretend to be Chris Rosen one day.
Well, yeah, yes. We had an awkward situation where Chris Rosen was on the line and Kyle was on the line, unbeknownst to Chris Rosen, doing a Chris Rosen impersonation.
And the best thing was the movie Kyle guessed would be a Chris Rosen movie pick was actually the movie that Chris Rosen picked that week.
Those were dark days in the show's history. Sure to tune in tomorrow. And next week, we will be on vacation. I will be taking Myla to what is that noise? I'll be taking Myla to a re-education camp where she will learn not to issue such scathing commentaries. And we will have, I think, we will have 4 days of new content next week. We'll be interviewing. We were talking about a book on Upton Sinclair. We'll be interviewing Shenna Bellows, the senatorial candidate in Maine. She is a progressive liberal candidate. We will also be providing some interviews that I did down at Families USA, some on healthcare, some on other issues. So it should be an interesting week. Just wanted to let you know. 646-257-3920 is the number if you want to be a part of this program. 646-257-3920. The IM is up. Folks, your membership makes this show possible. Become a member today by going to majority.fm. Don't make me do another Teaser Tuesday on a different day. Also, if you buy crap from Amazon, go to majorityreportkickback.com, click on the Amazon link, bookmark it, use it as your Amazon. You will notice no difference. We will get a kickback. It is your way of supporting the show without it costing you anything. But maybe a one-time investment of about 90 seconds. If you drink coffee, tea, or chocolate, you should be getting fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. And the best place to get fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate is from the Madison-based JustCoffee.coop. They're a co-op, employer-owned, employee-owned. Employer, I guess they're employers and employees simultaneously. Great coffee. And you get 10% off using the coupon code MAJORITY. Don't forget to give us a review on iTunes. Pick up the app. It's free. MajorityApp.com. Listen to the show live. Listen to our backlog of wonderful interviews. MajorityApp.com.
See you in the second half of the show.